Tosin, quickly, what was one of your favorite things about this episode?
I liked when Jesus came up to Shadow and you saw this sort of halo effect whenever he was whenever the lights were above his head, and he essentially told Shadow, I know you before he walked away.
Okay, all right. I dig that. Andy, what about you?
For me, it was Bilquis's backstory, learning about what her backstory was, and seeing that all that fleshed out.
Nice. For me, it was when Wednesday ran over those rabbits. That felt really good. I thought that was nice. But I hope you guys are satisfied, because when it comes to season one of American Gods, that's a wrap.
Hello and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast, episode 8, Come to Jesus. We are your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Andrew Saracini.
And Tosin Unnefelwachin.
We just watched the 8th and final episode of Starz American Gods' first season, titled Come to Jesus, and we assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the aftertalk. But before we do, let's catch you up on how to reach us. Here are our online links. You could follow us on Twitter at GodsPodcast, or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods. You can write us or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom and add us on iTunes. And if you do so, please like us and leave a review. That's how we get our show noticed. Before we get into the minutiae of this particular episode, Dwayne, why don't you give us a brief recap of what we saw tonight?
Sure thing. So we start with Mr. Nancy, the spider god from Africa. He gives us the coming to America, and it's like the Belkis edition. It covers her time in ancient Egypt and Nubia through into the Iranian Revolution. And then, in a rare thing for this universe, we see a god actually bringing herself to America rather than arriving through someone else's beliefs. Belkis falls destitute, is offered a merger with the new gods, just like we saw with Wednesday. Meanwhile, Wednesday and Shadow head to Kentucky, where they meet Easter. Wednesday appeals to Easter to help him despite her protestations that she does not like him. Laura arrives with Mad Sweeney, and they ask Easter to resurrect her, but Easter states she can't since Laura was killed by a god. Mad Sweeney confesses that it was Wednesday that killed her. And at the same time, media shows up to remind Easter she's only relevant because her holiday is Christian and they're in America. And Wednesday manages to kill all of media's minions with bolts of lightning. Then he dedicates their deaths to Easter, revealing himself to Shadow as Odin, which he had hinted throughout the series. And Easter takes that favor from Odin and uses it to hold the spring, that is the season spring, ransom, much to media's dismay. At the end of all that, Laura confronts the group, saying she needs a word with her husband. And then, as Shakespeare would say, exeunt. That's it.
Chased by a bear.
Exactly.
Thanks, Dwayne. So let's move on to the salient visual, stylistic, and thematic points of the episode. Dwayne, what stood out to you in this particular episode?
Well, I mean, that exit, the ending was weird. Like, I get hip cliffhangers, but for all the shows got going, Laura having that last line rather than Easter or media, one of the major players of that episode,
yeah,
that was weird. That didn't leave me feeling, that didn't leave me feeling strong. Didn't leave me feeling it was a strong ending that I'm gonna be thinking about. But I guess I'm talking about it now, so it was strong enough.
Right. In my opinion, that whole last section was a little bit of a mess. There was so much going on there, and it wasn't entirely clear cut. And hopefully we'll get into a little bit more of that later.
Yeah.
Tosin, what about you? Do you have any salient thoughts about this particular episode?
Well, one of the things that we tend to focus on is the episodic titles and kind of what they mean. Now, this episode's title was Come to Jesus. And for those who've never heard of that idiom, it essentially means like coming to facing the facts or coming to the terms of your reality. In this episode, it sort of was figurative in terms of everyone appeared at this party and Jesus. There were many Jesuses around, and so
it was like literal. It was like figurative and literal.
Yeah, figurative and literal. Yeah, so the literal definition is they were all there coming to Jesus. Figuratively speaking, there were several elements of that. One was, I think, Laura coming to terms that she is, in fact, dead, and right now there doesn't look like a way of bringing her back to life. And then I think there's, you know, a bit more Shadow, especially coming to terms that, hey, this is in fact Odin, and finally, you know, trying to recognize what he does believe, and finally accepting that he does believe everything that's happening, rather than
I believe everything,
right? Rather than just being a bystander, a helpless bystander in the entire thing, who's always freaked out about everything. And then I think Mr. World actually comes to realize that there is going to be a war and there's no turning back. So I think those were a few of the ones in this episode. Are there any others that you guys want to call out?
I think Mia felt as if she had everything under control. And that's how she normally works, right?
Yeah.
I'm Lucy. I'm floating in and I'm telling you what's going on. I'm floating in as Marilyn and I'm giving you, look at my presentation. How could you say no to this? You know, the Odin missile, and then you've got David Bowie telling Technical Boy, like, you're going to do what I say because I say it. And meanwhile, she's got her minions behind her, and they're multiplying and doing a lot of this stuff, and they're ready to kind of, like, they're strong in numbers, and then Odin kind of comes out of nowhere with a snowflake and a cloud and zaps them all down, and she's got to realize, oh, there's power here that I had not respected. She's not sure how Odin got that power, but
also, there's the coming to terms of Bilquis realizing that her power is then subservient to Technical Boy, when Technical Boy basically offers to lift her up out of her obscurity. So she's now subservient to Mr. World and Technical Boy.
Yeah, she's now an agent of those guys. She owes Technical Boy a big favor, and she is planning on cashing it in despite her her disinterest in all that, right? She's kind of been, I wouldn't say above the fray, pardon me, but not really into whatever's going on in terms of, like, the battle for, like, the power. She's been kind of doing her own thing. And doing well in terms of her own worship sacrifice scheme, and yeah, that's pretty interesting. So speaking of worship,
yeah,
I thought, you know, when we're talking about Bilquis, there is a great quote from Technical Boy. He goes, "Worship is a volume business. Mm-hmm. Whosoever has the most followers wins the game," and I really like that because I thought, you know, even in today's politics, you know, there's a lot of talk about, like, Christianity versus Islam, and, like, you know, the news media likes to throw out who's got more numbers, right? But at the same time, you've also got this situation where you know, this is Technical Boy talking, and he's talking to a goddess, and he's effectively saying it's all about the followers. And from Technical Boy to say that in an age of, like, Twitter and even Facebook that counts followers on certain pages, I thought that was really well done, really cleverly done, and really tied into what this series is all about, understanding what the basic tenets of culture are, regardless of whether it's a secular culture or a religious culture, or seeing how the two interplay with one another as they do in our world today. But I thought that was pretty clever.
Another thing that was pretty interesting in this episode is Sweeney's conversation with Laura after she kind of has him by the balls. Literally speaking, and, you know, Laura's questioning him about, like, God's just fucking with people, and he said, "What do you think gods do? They do what they've always done. They fuck with us," and that's kind of something that you see and hear repeated, right? We actually noticed a bunch of this in the book too, in terms of like things that Wednesday would do. But what do you guys think about this, Andy?
I mean, I think that there's definitely this definitely ties into sort of the in particular the ancient sort of, maybe not necessarily the Norse gods, but definitely the ancient Greek gods paradigm of someone like Zeus being not so much a benevolent overseeing god, but the kind of a god that imparted their own selfish will on humans. And, you know, like the Zeus would come down to Earth and have sex with all these humans and then just either, you know, leave them or kill them. So that, I think that touches upon something that bit of dialogue that Laura says.
Yeah, kind of. It strikes me too. So the Norse gods were similarly petty, like the Greco-Roman gods, and this idea that gods are not these like venerable, beautiful, caring, father-like figures.
Right.
Even though Odin's called Allfather, they manipulate people to their purposes. And, you know, back in the day, before the Scandinavian countries became Christian, when they still believed in these gods, this was pretty helpful for quick and rapid political change and stuff. You know, you could say, well, that king over there, or that earl or whatever, he's got the power of Odin behind him. Or you could be like, well, you fell out of Odin's favor, and that's why you lost that battle. That's why you did this, that's why you did that. It's all about, like, gaining favor and what you have to do to maintain favor with the gods. And even if you do everything you have to do, they still screw with you. Let's look back to the very first episode when Odin first showed up on American shores. You know, those Scandinavian guys came and they got taken out.
Right.
In their layout, they're just like, yeah, it's got to be. It's not the fact that there are natives here already because they came over on a land bridge 13,000 or 100,000 years before. It's because clearly Odin wants to mess with us. So fine, we'll give Odin whatever he wants. We'll give him our eyes. We'll have a battle and give him our blood. We'll hang one of our people. And it just gives you another reason why people lived in fear of these gods for so long, and why they continue to live in fear of, you know, the Judeo-Christian Islamic God right now, because this idea that, like, everything's predestined, God's already made choices about you, you know, be prepared. That's a heavy-hitting thing. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Because Laura, as a person who's never believed, nor clearly had any religious education to begin with at all, is incredulous that this could happen. In her head, everything happened because of whether it's bad luck or it's, you know, because she made a choice. And realizing that she's not in control is a pretty strong thing for her to have to deal with. The idea that she thought she had it. And, you know, when you look at the actual footage of the episode where, you know, they depict her and Robbie dying, it looks very much like she hit the gear shift, right?
Yeah.
But now we know that however that was manipulated, it wasn't just chance. And perhaps there is no chance. The perfect plan fell apart because there's somebody above or below or whatever influencing things. What really got me was that how she was like, you could see it on her, the actress's face, how it's sinking in. That they fuck with her, that they fuck with people, and I thought, yeah, that was pretty cool. But Andy, what do you think of this whole Easter thing? Speaking of gods,
well, Wednesday says, you could call this Easter, or we could call it what it really is—a pagan ritual in celebration of the beginning of spring, dating back about 12,000 years. And I think that basically he is emphasizing to Shadow Moon that we have these rituals, that everything is really goes back to the beginning of worship. And so in this case, the beginning of worship, which is from, you know, the beginning of our culture and rooted in the seasonal changes and how that stuff has evolved with our religion and has evolved to transform with our religion. So Easter, which was a pagan religion, just basically got tagged on to Christianity as Christianity evolved. So,
which is like a merger, right? Not like what the new gods want to do with people like Odin or Saint Nicholas or whatever. This merger thing, like Easter, is like kind of like the first merger. This idea that the vernal equinox or whatever the spring equinox, whatever it is, they're like, yeah, man, you know, we're just gonna we do that anyway. We're just gonna say it's when Jesus was resurrected.
Right.
That's like what the show is saying.
Which doesn't really account for rabbits and eggs and all the other sort of spring rebirth rituals that came over from the pagan era.
Yeah, and that made me think, like, you know, this 12,000-year number that was thrown out, that's pretty interesting to me because from everything that I know, you said our culture, and I mean, like, yeah, like civilization, right? Like, 10,000 years ago had an ice age that began to thaw out and we got the climate that we have today, which has been really, really helpful for growth. Like modern humans have been around for like close to, you know, 100,000 years and hadn't done much. But once the ice age ended and we got the tight ass climate and we were able to do like the agriculture and stuff, then we really got to a place where we could begin to get progress. And now we're standing in front of computers and talking and stuff. And, I thought it was interesting that he went back to 12K, that he went, he had like, he threw out that number, and that the way he looks at the world, it doesn't, you know, we always talk about how Odin's a liar or whatever, and everyone's like, yeah, he's a charlatan or whatever.
Yeah.
He's kind of like, well, you know, truth, man, I'll say what I think is right. Maybe. I'll say what I want to say, and you'll just believe that it's right. And maybe that's the whole thing about Shadow having to believe in him, this idea that, like, I want to say it and see if you believe it, right? I want to say, I want to say it. I don't want you to really challenge it. I just want your belief. I want your sex, like George Michael used to sing.
Well, it may just also be the showrunners playing fast and loose with accuracy as far as, you know, how old the earth is or how old the climate is. Anything else you noticed about that scene, about the visit to Easter celebration, Dwayne?
Yeah. You know, obviously everyone is there and, you know, Odin's trying to like lay out this idea that like Easter isn't about Easter. It's about Jesus now. And Easter's like, no, I'm cool. But I thought it was pretty interesting. During all those shots, you know, you see a woman breastfeeding a child, reminiscent of the fertility associated with the 12,000-year-old holiday. You know, she's wearing the blue that's associated with Mary the Virgin, and Christ is a baby. And you're like, but I just saw Christ. And then they do this great thing where, so once, you know, first you see the woman breastfeeding the kid, you're like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
And then the sconces with the halo light that comes up behind people's heads. Like, that was a great digital effect. Tosin mentioned it earlier. That was cool. But it was only once that happened that I recognized her as Mary, wearing the blue, feeding the suckling child, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you begin to realize, okay, you've already seen an incarnation of Jesus. But if she's holding the baby, that's the baby Jesus. And if you've ever been a kid at Easter, knowing that just a couple months ago you celebrated Christ's life, now you're celebrating his death, it's a little confusing until you realize that he had to die sometime, right?
Yeah.
So you're looking at this thing and you're like, okay, so there's more than one Jesus. And then it's almost as if they know that's where your mind was going to go. Because then they start laying over Jesus upon Jesus upon Jesus, which also matters because just two episodes ago, we saw Jesus get shot to death by Vulcan's weapons. So I think it was really well done. It's sort of like, let's get someone to make the logical leaps based on the nuggets we're giving.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we'll just kind of run with it. And run with it they did, between seeing stigmata show up in people's hands or Jesus sitting on the water, that kind of thing.
But,
and, you know, go ahead.
By the way, at Easter's party there, where they had all the snacks laid out on the table, They had stigmata cookies, you know, with little red dots in the center of hands. And I've never seen those outside of this show. So I don't know if that's a traditional Easter thing, but I've never
seen. That is not a thing in my Catholic upbringing. I also feel like
it's hitting the metaphor a little hard.
Yeah, I could totally see me doing that now, making little stigmatas.
Right.
You know, the little pink gooey center of a sugar cookie.
Yeah, yeah.
You've seen those? Like making the sugar cookie in someone's hand? Because it's like morbid. And awesome. But yeah, so it's one of those things where I think they did a really good job of laying all that out. And I thought that we were treated, I think, to seeing how, you know, Fuller and Green wanted to play with our expectation of how they were going to depict Jesus, especially if you're familiar with Neil Gaiman having said that he couldn't figure out how to get Jesus to work because he thought it would be a heavy hand to play. And what's really interesting about that is that Jesus didn't have like a lot of, you know, you would think he'd have all this kind of super overt power, right? Because he's Jesus. But his role in the Bible is one of, you know, even when he's on the cross, he doesn't like kind of like use the power of God to free himself. He's sort of passive. His miracles are like laid back miracles, like turning water into wine, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he's not a super power kind of guy like that. More he's got this, you know, in some incarnations he's a counselor vibe, and other ones he's a straight up like priest looking dude. It was a cool way to get that, the overriding kind of multiculturalism that the show is playing with, to use that to depict Jesus. So I thought that was pretty cool. But enough about that. There was a big reveal scene, guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Andy, I want to know specifically what you thought of Grimnir / Odin / Wednesday.
Yeah.
Laying it out to the thickest guy in the room, Shadow Moon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, seriously, I'm sorry, but haven't we all at this point figured out that Wednesday is Odin, the Norse god? And if Shadow Moon hasn't figured it out yet by this point in the show, this feels to me like the worst reveal ever, because it's like, duh, like everybody knows this.
The worst kept secret in all of show business.
Exactly. On top of which, it did sort of push into the hyper melodramatic, I would say, with the lightning and the jittery camera. And the, yeah. What did you think, Tosin?
Frightening.
I mean, I looked at it and I remember thinking, like just like you said, like this is like the opposite of the way Westworld does things.
Yeah. Like, Westworld will have this sort of, if this were Westworld, Dr. Ford would have this monologue, and by the time you come to the end of the monologue, you sort of re-examine what he said in your mind, and you're like, oh my god, like the jaw drops when you realize what he's actually saying. The subtext of what he's actually saying. In this, there is no subtext at all.
Yeah, was that supposed to be surprising for the audience? Because
No one's paying attention, right?
I guess we've all read the book, so maybe that taints us a little bit.
Could be.
It was a little too over the top, a little too CGI. I mean, there was a good build up, but then at the point where he's like, "I'm gonna strike them all down," like, oh, I guess so. And actually, the
matter of fact, I guess so. I guess that worked.
Well, the funny thing is, because like you know how Mr. World is essentially saying, "Hey, we've got guns, you have knives, etc., etc." And he's like, "No, I don't actually not using the sword. I'm gonna use lightning."
Right. Like you forget what my real power is.
Right. Even there, like you know, so you know, Jesus is in the water. That's a pretty cool power. But did you guys notice the kind of Highlander moment when he's in the room with Easter? It's like, look, he made the sword for me. Whoop!
Right. The sword just sort of comes out of nowhere.
If you've ever watched the original Highlander movie, or not even the second Highlander movie, which no one should ever watch, or the TV show, which was a lot of fun in the 90s, they lived in this world. It was a modern world, regular world.
Yeah.
And somehow you know, Connor McLeod or Duncan, I forgot, it's his cousin. He would be able to pull a full length Japanese katana out of whatever outfit he was wearing. And if Odin can fold time and space better than the TARDIS with his magical jacket that I guess Mr. Nancy sewed for him, then that's the kind of power that you don't see. You know, I mean, you can hop into a TV. That's cool. But I can pull out a sword. And guess what? I'm not going to tell you this, but I used it to cut off my friend's head after he made it for me. So I've got more power than you think I've got. And I think Wednesday, as a con artist, has been able to pretty effectively up to this point lay out his pretty much have people underestimate his power.
Right.
And for the last few episodes, we've seen his power actually much stronger than we assumed it was. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like now I'm thinking back to episode one, maybe this is a little Westworldy, and I'm thinking, you know, when they hit that storm, that was definitely Wednesday putting that plane down.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, we've realized at this point that Wednesday had sort of engineered...
pulling some strings.
Yeah, engineered from the very beginning, Shadow Moon's fate to bring him to him.
Right. So. And we know, I mean, if you read the book, that idea is out there.
Yeah.
But the idea of Shadow actually getting caught and going to jail because of Wednesday.
Yeah.
Not in the book, but would have made the book maybe even a little bit tighter. And I did like that. But now that we've seen, you know, Wednesday drop Rain so he can have his moment and kiss his girlfriend in Chicago, and now zap a whole bunch of minions to death, it's pretty clear that, you know, when it comes to what he's doing, you know, it takes him a while to brew it, but when he brews it, it's pretty frankly, it's kind of Gandalfian, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of makes sense since Gandalf was designed around the idea of an Odin, you know, this wandering man with the big fat hat, yada yada yada.
Sure.
But
so yeah, that's the salient points for this episode. Let's move on to the big picture, guys. That's the section where we discuss how the events in this particular episode impact what we know about the overarching story arc. Tosin, why don't you start us off?
So yeah, let's start talking about the supernaturals we see in this episode. The first one we see is Jesus and several different imaginations of Jesus from, you know, various races and various other sort of stories and ideals. And, you know, for those who don't know who... Well, okay, sorry. Everyone knows who Jesus is, right? Right?
Right.
Most people.
How would you describe...
At least a couple billion people know who Jesus is.
Yeah, I mean, a couple billion people know. I mean, how would you describe if someone's like, okay, I'm a 4-year-old, daddy, who's Jesus?
The blackest mother ever.
Sacrilege aside.
I mean, in this episode, we do have Jesus, who is an individual from the Bible, who, you know, died for the sins of the people, and the incarnation.
Son of God. That's kind of a thing.
Son of God. Yes, that's important. That's an important piece. And part of one of the elements that I think is sort of pretty important here is something that I mentioned in the beginning of how Shadow wasn't how Shadow, you know, first met Jesus and was like, do I know you? And I think we see this in the New Testament where, you know, after Jesus has been resurrected, and there's several examples of like someone going around doing miracles and people like thinking they know who it is and then realizing later on that was Jesus who did this.
Mm-hmm. He's on stealth, man. That's how he rolls out with the New Testament.
Yeah.
After the resurrection, yeah.
Exactly. And it's fairly interesting that this episode is really sort of centered around Jesus's presence. We know that from the book itself, Jesus was not part of the original text. He was in essentially an epilogue, and there was sort of a desire to have him incorporated. I guess what I'm sort of curious is whether or not Jesus makes further appearances, or if this is just the only time we see him.
Yeah, we did see another version of Jesus getting killed by Vulcan, Spanish-speaking Jesus helping those people cross the border. So that was kind of cool. Andy hated that incarnation. Well, he hated the story around that incarnation of Jesus, right?
Yeah. It wasn't.
He didn't
it
was so much hate the incarnation.
No,
he hated the story around the incarnation.
It was that whole open in the Vulcan episode was just a little too heavy-handed for me. Nothing.
Yeah, I'm
subtle
still
about
wrapping
it.
My head around the Vulcan episode.
Yeah.
It's still fuzzy. I feel like the whole. Yeah, I mean, obviously, we were on Twitter, and I had interpreted things in a funny way, but yeah, it's that episode is heavy. Who else do we see in this situation? We see Easter, right? She's kind of it's called Come to Jesus.
Yeah,
there's a lot of Jesus, and we think about Easter being about Jesus, but this episode was almost a lot more about Easter than it was about Jesus. And who is she, right? So Easter, is derived from Eos or Esther. Oh, not Esther as in Esther in the Bible, but like O with a little line inside of it.
Right.
And then E-S-T-E-R, right?
In the show, Wednesday pronounces it as Astera.
Astera, right. Astera is the dawn. And the Greeks also had an entity for the dawn. And that was Eos, who was a titan. So mm-hmm. a pre-god supernatural. And it's interesting to see her here. So what we know then is that Easter is one of the oldest of the old gods, right? If you're looking back at the situation, you know, Wednesday describes it as this festival having to do with the vernal equinox and renewal and rebirth. And, you know, some of us know that a little bit inherently. We're kind of taught like, okay, there's a maypole during Easter, and there's this thing with the rabbits and the eggs and this idea of rejuvenation and rebirth. She represents the entity, the supernatural entity that was incarnated with all of that. And then as Christianity kind of came into the world, as Andy said, it got, there was the first merger really happened. They were like, okay, we're going to take this old thing and we're going to merge it with Christianity. But even before Christianity merged with it, the Greco-Roman religion merged with it. And that's where you get Eos from, the goddess of the dawn, mm-hmm. or the titan of the dawn, mm-hmm. really. Hyperion's daughter. Hyperion is the sun, the titan of the sun. And then you get Eos out of that. So, you know, from the super ancient world, let's call it 12,000 years ago to go with Wednesday's quote, to like, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago with the ancient Greeks, and then up to now with Christianity, people have been venerating this moment in time, right. This moment when the sun is doing, the earth is doing a specific piece of its work around the sun. And that gives her an interesting amount of, let's call it favor, right? When it comes to the worship she gets, every year, billions of people are like, I'm all about Easter. And they've got her bunnies, and they've got her, you know, much to my chagrin, those bunnies, but they've got her her eggs. And they're talking about her. And in this universe that we're looking at the show in, that gets her the kind of favor she needs to live the life that she wants to live. Like, she's not kind of destitute with, like, pox marks on her face. The way
the life of being constantly worshipped on a regular basis.
Right, exactly. I had a word that I was going to use, but basically she's got that life force. That God force is powerful. Her levels are high because of all this stuff.
Right.
But what's interesting is because of the Jesus connection, you know, the myth of her, and she's from myths, right? Mm-hmm. That gets broken down in pretty significant ways. So at first you see her like, wow, she's doing really well. She's got all this stuff. Jesus is rolling around her. That's got to be big. And then the first thing you see is that, you know, Wednesday's kind of breaking down. Well, this isn't really what it looks like because she just happens to be kind of in the virtuous cycle with the Jesus thing. And then if you're thinking that Wednesday is just kind of like jealous, then you get media who's basically like, look, you're only here because you're Christian, because it's a Christian holiday and the calendar lined up nicely for you. Right. We made with you the same deal we made with Saint Nick.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So I think it's a pretty interesting characterization. I mean, we can get into how Chenoweth played it a little later when we like to talk about performances. But I thought that it was pretty powerful. We also have a question about another god in this, and that is when Laura finds out that Mad Sweeney killed her after Easter said that you were killed by a god.
Right.
Laura turns to him and says, "No, you're not a god." You know, and I wanted to know what you guys thought of that. Like Mad Sweeney in, you know, the S.E. Tregowan episode, episode 9, Prayer for Mad Sweeney. You know, first of all, it's called Prayer for Mad Sweeney.
Right.
Right. So that's kind of for him, not to him. That supports Laura a little bit. But at the same time, their sacrifice is being given to Mad Sweeney, right? The milk and the salt being put out for him. The stories being told about him. I know we don't think of a leprechaun traditionally as a god, but at the same time, when you look at Mad Sweeney's past story and everything like that, you know, like the king he was based on that got venerated, there seems to be definitely, like, I'm not going to say Laura was right and, you know, Mad Sweeney's wrong, but the discrepancy, I think, is an interesting one. How are we defining gods? Like, we've been using the term supernaturals on the show when we talk about it, but what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, maybe it could also be because she doesn't believe in him. And for something to be a god, you have to have that belief that, you know, Shadow gained at the end where he's like, okay, I accept everything. I believe everything. I believe that you are Odin and that you are all powerful and all father. And so maybe because of the situation she's been in with Mad Sweeney and Laura's sort of power and grip over him and grip over his manhood, she sees him as sort of inferior and doesn't recognize his power. And therefore, you know, if you don't believe in something, it becomes more human. It doesn't seem so outworldly.
So to Laura, he's not a god.
Yes, exactly.
That was a pretty dope breakdown, Tosin. I dig it. I mean, Andy, what do you think in terms of, like, the god, not god situation?
I mean, it feels like that there's definitely, when you use the term god, it feels like there's definitely a hierarchy that you're imposing on that being. And I feel like when you are talking about someone like the Mr. World or Easter or a Wednesday, that to me, I feel like is adequate description of someone who's a god. But when we talk about someone like
Technical Boy
or a Mad Sweeney or Anubis, maybe even. I'm not entirely sure. It's a little shaky as to whether or not they are gods or demigods, or I'm not sure how you would break down that classification below absolute god, you know?
Yeah, I mean, on some level, it's kind of like, can it be a god if you don't know that you're worshiping it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Anubis may not enjoy the levels of favor Jesus has, yeah. Right?
And
same time, Anubis was a god. That is chronicled, you know. But when you look at, like, Mad Sweeney, was a leprechaun a god? That's a little messier. And Technical Boy, and Media, and Mr. World, you know, powerful. But at the same time, again, if you don't know you're worshiping it,
right?
Can it be a god? Is that one of the reasons why they seem so kind of insecure, you know?
And
like, those guys are constantly saying, hey, give it up. But that's also kind of what you'd say if you don't want to let somebody know that you're not secure about your position. You want them to give it up. You know what I mean?
And I have another sort of mind-blowing question for you here. Where does Laura fit into that categorization? We're talking about someone who is undead, who has these supernatural powers, strengths. Is she a god or not? And if gods are those that are defined by their being worshipped, what does that make Shadow Moon? Because Laura clearly worships him now.
Sure. And we don't know what's going on with like any kind of power he'd have.
Right.
We do know that, yeah, Laura's got this power. Now, she is a... And this is, I think, the reason why we decided to use the term supernaturals when we were figuring out how we were going to format the show. Because Laura is clearly a supernatural character. Her power is, you know, she's kind of like reanimated, right?
Yeah.
So much so that when, you know, when the coin fell out of her body, she was ostensibly gone until Matt Sweeney put it back in. So, you know, I feel like really hesitant to use the term God with her. She's kind of like a magical creature right now. And, yeah, but since Shadow is her God, you know, she believes in Shadow. And, you know, that's kind of how she feels like she exists and all that stuff. Yeah, there's something to that.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead.
That's interesting. She's a little weird because, you know, that there is that whole bow tie that Easter put on her like actual skin at the
she's
end.
She's trying to neaten her up though. Like, right. She's like, your tits are falling off. Like, let me just
even from the beginning of the episode, or from even where she was in the bathroom to like when she ends up on the balcony, she looks so much
deader.
Yeah, she looks so much worse.
Right.
She takes damage like a D&D character, right? So like, when she flew out of the truck, like, she took significant damage. And then because she's rotting and the flies are flying around her because she smells bad. And what do flies do? They lay their eggs in dead things.
Yeah.
And then their maggots eat the dead things. So she's been being eaten from the inside. Like, when she spits up the maggots, they're not just in there because they're in there. They're in there because they're feasting on her innards.
Right.
So she's literally less a person than she was. Those maggots are literally made of bits of her.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, yeah. That definitely makes sense. And I'm sorry to anyone who might be eating while listening to this.
Right. So, I mean, like, it'd be fun if some, you know, maybe Matt Sweeney got the coin from some crazy necromancing guy. I don't know. But it's definitely pretty pretty strange. Yeah, I thought that was interesting. And then, like, you know, how do we look a technical boy? You know, I could. There's obviously a case for us worshiping social media, worshiping our phones. You know, media says that, you know, people looking at her screens is better than lamb's blood, which is an obvious reference to like the sacrifice Abraham ended up making. Instead of like sacrificing his son Isaac, he sacrificed the lamb. So there's a lot there. But Tosin, how did Belkis feel about Technical Boy?
Well, in her phone, she did refer to him as the man, and so we clearly know that's most likely not in a good way, since she was avoiding his calls. But
good idea of how the hierarchy that
right, very subservient. I think at a point she tried to, you know, while she was trying to seduce him, trying to gain power back on him,
eat him with her vagina.
Yeah, yeah. He was having none of that, and so we can definitely see sort of the relationship between them. And this, you know, for those who've read the books, this interpretation sort of fills in some of the blanks that I think we're missing as we follow her journey.
Yeah, I really feel as if so in the book. You know, Technical Boy actually does away with her, right? He ends up killing her because she's an old god and he's the new jammy. But here he uses her. Now, there's plenty of time for him to still kill her. And, you know, if you want to look at the kind of paradigm being set up here, he could be the pimp and she can be the whore, the prostitute. And pimps kill their prostitutes all the time. But it was interesting that she's looking at him as the man, that is to say, the person who's in control and abuses power, that kind of thing. So that was pretty interesting.
So overall, in this season that we've seen, a few interesting themes have sort of stood out here, and one of them is the deals that old gods took with new gods. For example, with Easter. You know, we have the story that we've talked about before about Ostere adding basically subsuming her worship of her specifically as a goddess to once she started to get forgotten, and just sort of tagging that worship on to Jesus, the resurrection, as a way to keep herself alive. And in this episode, Media refers to Saint Nick, the same deal with Christmas.
Yeah, that really got me. That was a great little reference, because you know you're constantly hearing about how Christmas is now about presents and whatever and whatever, and it almost feels as if society made that bargain that like we're gonna keep this Christmas thing, but when you listen to the news about Christmas, it's all about whether or not did retail make a lot of money,
right?
Like, are they in the black? Are they whole? Was it a good was it a good Christmas season for business, or was it not? Like, it's like that whole deal situation was made. Also, Saint Nicholas, if you think about it in terms of the Easter thing, you know, his birthday just happened to be, or like his feast day happens to be when Christ is born, or when we celebrate when Christ was born.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's got to be sitting pretty too. Just another bit of luck of the calendar, you know what I mean? He gets the vernal equinox, she gets the spring equinox. I don't know the terms, but right. That idea that like these two guys made out big, in terms of like the lottery of the calendar, in terms of being who they are. But that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Although technically, you know, even that is a little bit of a kludge, because
we don't know when the guy was born, and no, we just use it down there.
Right, and it more falls in line again with more pagan rituals.
Right, it's the same exact deal, which is what's so tight about that one line. It gives you so much information by saying, "Yeah, you know, you got the same. We made the same deal with you that we made with Saint Nick. That was great."
Media's merger offer to Wednesday, which we saw in a previous episode, where, you know, Media, when they're in the police station, and Media basically says to Wednesday, you know what, you won't be forgotten. This is the new deal. You know, we will name a satellite. Was it a satellite or a missile after you in North Korea, and your name will be venerated from there on out. So,
and this is interesting because it kind of, now that we've seen Belkis fly on a plane.
Yeah.
It kind of changes the paradigm a little bit, because it used to be that at least in the stories that we read, American Gods, you know, Wednesday was the American incarnation of Odin. Nancy was the American incarnation of Anansi, right? And, you know, if Media is basically saying, we're going to put your name in North Korea, then these incarnations are kind of worldwide incarnations, right? Because how could Wednesday in America, in the traditional sense of American Gods, benefit from a North Korean love of Odin? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting. And then obviously, instead of, you know, like we see that Mad Sweeney was brought here by the beliefs of S.H. Gowan, so that's the old school style of American Gods. But at the same time, Belkis got on an actual airplane and flew over. So that was also interesting. So it's unclear, kind of like the jurisdiction of the gods we see.
Right? Do they have to travel with somebody's belief, or can they come themselves like Belkis did, with, you know, physically put herself on a plane and travel over?
Right. Exactly. But yeah, this was this idea of like the merging.
Yeah.
Speaks a lot to how culture actually works. Things transform. They don't necessarily get obliterated or taken away. Now, we've seen when things try to get obliterated, and that was actually there in the show. Belkis, in 2013, she's watching ISIS destroy her monuments all over parts of the Middle East or Africa. She's watching terrorist groups say that these monuments to her are in fact, you know, pagan or whatever,
right.
Infidel, whatever. And because of that, she becomes more and more ill. you know?
Right.
And
right.
So
more
that's
forgotten.
Kind of the,
More forgotten.
Right. And that's kind of the rare exception, I feel like, in history. You know, there's been obviously some ethnic cleansing, other things to get rid of people's belief systems. But for the most part, I feel like, you know, for instance, when the Moors took over Spain for like 700 years, they came in there and they didn't force the Spaniards to all become Muslim. In fact, Spaniards kind of, many of them kind of just stayed Catholic. And they had to pay some more taxes. But and they adopted certain things like Spanish churches and other things have some interesting architectural elements that tie in with the Islamic ones, Islamic mosques. But you look at that and you see again a merger or a mixing rather than an obliteration. So it's as if the death of all gods really is typically a slow death. You know, and think about last time someone really was like, yo, my man Odin, I'm playing to you right now. I mean, that was probably in like, I don't know, 1100 AD. So it's been a long time since people really got into the Odin thing. But he's still kind of lingering because of the way we keep it. You know, when it's like things like Wednesday, we still use the term Wednesday.
Yeah.
We still think about him that way. So I thought that whole idea of the merger was pretty strong throughout the series, and they're working really hard to kind of like fuse it with the way we actually live our lives instead of just telling a story from a book.
So another theme that we have here is worship, right? And this is, I think, the dynamic between worship and sacrifice. The worship providing that sort of power to the gods. We see that with like Vulcan is one example of that, and potentially with Mad Sweeney, whatever he becomes, you know, whether or not he's a god or a minion or however you take that to be. But we see that as something that's empowering, and empowering a lot of the new gods like Techno Boy. But it also does serve as sort of a distraction too, right? It's this innovative distraction from everything else that's occurring, from everything, from it's this distraction that allows sort of the gods to continue on their way and do kind of whatever they want. And potentially part of that goes back to what Laura had said, or what Sweeney had said to Laura about the gods themselves just really fucking with them. So it's sort of interesting to see that dynamic played throughout the course of the season.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I mean, I look at it and I think to myself, you go back to the whole Old Testament situation, God's like, hey, Abram, you know you love me, right? So what are you gonna do for me? He's like, I'm going to sacrifice my son. He's like, no, just sacrifice a lamb. And then at this point in our history, right, you know, people still believe in Judaism and Christianity and stuff. No one's really sacrificing lambs anymore. Instead, you know, the power comes from worship, not sacrifice. But the old gods, they had access to both. You know, you'd look back at the Eric the Red, or the pre-Eric the Red sequence from the first episode, and again, they sacrificed their eyes, they sacrificed their lives, they sacrificed their countrymen, their shipmate, and that's how Odin got so much strength in the new world, because the sacrifice is made, right? The idea that like I'm going to give up this thing that matters to me for you, and then you see him do an actual sacrifice to Easter. He actually goes and he dedicates lives that he takes to Easter, and it seems like with the old gods, sacrifice is where the big money is, let's call it.
Yeah.
Whereas with the new gods, you got like Gillian Anderson's version of media. And early in the show, she goes, you know, well, you know, all this time, all this attention being spent looking at my screens, it's better than lamb's blood.
Yeah.
So in that case, you know, what is prayer, right? Prayer is you're giving your time and you're giving your thoughts. And on some level, you're sacrificing that time because you never get time back. How you spend it is how you spend it. You can't kind of get a refund, right? Unless you're like in a terrible Justin Timberlake movie. which I just, we'll put that in the ephemera. But what we have here, though, is Easter goes from being a person who can have an awesome house and get the attention of the many Jesuses and possibly even resurrect people to, you know, with the normal everyday worship she gets, or every year worship she gets. That's pretty powerful. But Odin finds a way to actually give her extra power, mm-hmm, by sacrificing lives to her. And what she does with that extra power is she decides to play the game, and she joins Odin's side, and she effectively stops spring from happening, which, random. Yeah. I think, I don't know if you guys, how you guys felt about when you saw things go from green to brown. You were like, okay, so what does that mean, and why would Easter make things worse if she's about renewal, right?
But doesn't spring like rejuvenate her the way sacrifices rejuvenate other gods?
Right, yeah, exactly. So I thought it was a little weird that she'd take away spring.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I was kind of like, well, what? Like, I guess she's like going to starve humanity?
Yeah, I'm not sure I get that either. But yeah, but again,
a little weird.
That whole the last like 10 minutes of this episode really to me was a little bit of a mess. There was so much going on and not much of it was very clear for me. And I read the book. So I know that it's a deliberate choice on the showrunners to move in this direction that seemed to clear stuff up not so much. You know, it was clearer in the book what was going on, and on top of which that none of this is really in the book, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah, I felt like there was the show has more, trying to make more layers than the book had. The book had layers, but they didn't try to kind of tie everything together as much as the show is trying to do, which is a narratively useful thing for the show to do, but it's it might take us a while to get there, but. Yeah, so Easter gets the sacrifice. She's super powerful, and you're like, okay, now we have no buds,
right?
And that's kind of how that happened. But that's, I guess, the whole worship theme, like how that works, the dynamics of it, how you pay it off, how you get it done, and we'll have to continue to see how that evolves over the course of the next season. But the last theme we've got is what we're calling the power of the feminine. And this isn't like a feminist concept. This is older than the idea of feminism. This is the idea of females having an inherent power. Now, in certain old times, if women were able to do something that was surprising, they might be called a witch or whatever. But what we're talking about is in the show, the way they've laid things out, they've actually had this focus on the power of the feminine that's been rooted to these ancient mystical situations. So, like, we meet Bilquis early in the show, right? We meet her super ridiculously early in the season. And the first thing we do is, you know, there's not, like, the traditional buildup of romance or whatever. I mean, we see this actress, like, effectively, like, buck-ass naked and then eating a man with her vagina.
Right.
And...
Right. Sounds like a Thursday night for me.
Okay. I think on some level, culturally, people are like, am I watching Skinamax right now? Or like what? You know what I mean? Like the Red Shoe Diaries, whatever that stuff used to be.
Yeah.
But this, you know, because there was no real context. It kind of just went straight to the sex. And I think there certain people look at that and they think, wow, that's pretty exploitative, right?
Yeah.
But I think when I look back at the entire run of the show, instead, we see that as we look at multiple cultures over the course of like human civilizations, the way that sex has been seen wasn't necessarily the way that we look at it now. So when Bilquis is using sex to get what she wants, it makes her less of a whore and more of a person with agency. And this kind of power of the feminine, she's able to use people's lust to fuel her. which is kind of a thing. We also get that Shadow is ruled by Laura when Laura is alive.
Right.
Right. So he shows up and he's like, hey, baby, and look at me. I'm stealing these chips and everything like that. I'm doing all that stuff. And she's like, dude, you're going to get in trouble. Dude, get out of here. And so he listens to her. He shows up at her car, and then she decides she wants to take him home. And he's basically in her thrall, called her puppy.
Right, right.
Throughout the rest of the thing. So that was also pretty interesting. And Laura is a really diminutive woman, right? It's Shadow is this huge, big, strong guy. And Laura is this like tiny, diminutive female. And in fact, when you look at sort of like the way we look at masculinity and femininity standards in America today, you know, Shadow's effectively a big black dude and she's like a little white girl, right? And that's that she has power over him kind of like lays into that same foundation of like the power of the feminine. Hyper-masculine, ultra-feminine, feminine still has power over male. And then we get to this whole situation with Essie Tregowan, also played by Emily Browning. And Tregowan, I mean, what does she do, right? She effectively takes the entire system that's meant to subdue people like her, people in her class. You know, any small offense, you're going to get hung because we can't feed all of you anyway. And she uses that to pretty much get what she wants. She tests the system, and then when she fails the test and is about to get hung again, she effectively gets herself knocked up, uses the agency of her body to protect herself, and then goes over to America and starts a new life and, you know, begins basically a new legacy. So that's also pretty powerful. And then we get to this whole thing, like, Andy, why do they call him Shadow?
Well, he explains in the show that it's because it's the way that he used to follow his mama around, and he said that she didn't know what else to call me. And I honestly don't remember in the book, although we're not really at this point talking about differences in the book and the show, but I don't remember in the book that was what that reason was in the book. So, but it's interesting that, again, you're tying into the power of the feminine, the power of the in this case, the maternal over the Shadow.
Right, right. I mean, in many worlds, you know, Shadow is obviously, there's something special about him, you know, and this idea that, like, in a lot of, whether you get Leave It to Beaver or Dennis the Menace, little boys treat kind of as princes. Yeah. And you have Shadow here, and his mom's like, you know, she's a hippie. So that's part of the reason why his name is Shadow. Mr. Wednesday calls her out as much as a hippie, big Afro, whatever. And then you see this quote, and it comes out of nowhere. It's just one line, but it lays out that, you know, not only was Shadow sort of subordinate to Laura, he was subordinate to his mother before Laura. And that's a big piece of who he was. Now Shadow doesn't really come across as a mama's boy, but clearly he was tied to that. And then, I mean, Tosin, we've got Easter. I mean, like, talk about the feminine with her.
Yeah, with Easter, she is incredibly powerful, right? She has this like huge party that everyone is attending. Wednesday brings up that, you know, that, hey, she's being marginalized. You know, people, the various Jesuses in there don't necessarily believe in her, and this is sort of their holiday, not hers anymore.
Yeah, it's a dude's holiday, right? Yeah. Like, it used to be a woman's holiday, and now it's a dude's holiday. Yeah, and we've seen that before, right? I mean, Wednesday says to Easter, you do all the work, he gets all the prayers. But we've also seen that elsewhere. The show lays out where else, like, guys take away women's power.
Yeah, earlier in the episode with Bilquis, we saw, you know, looking at the TV, we saw the Iranian Revolution, and that was painted as an attack specifically on women, right? Specifically on removing her power, and even earlier than before that, when she was in the club, right, with the guys with weapons who came in, or before, where there were gods, where there were male gods, I believe there were gods, who were trying to take away her power. So this seems to be this sort of constant theme of trying to make her be and make women be subservient throughout the course of the episode.
Or men feeling threatened by women's power.
Right.
The power of the feminine, yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, Nancy doesn't seem to believe that you can win without her, right, Andy?
Yeah, yeah. He tells Odin that the point of the story was that you need a queen in order to win. You know, that's the takeaway. That,
yeah, like the game of chess, right?
Right, right, right. I didn't even think about that, but you're right.
Yeah. Which is also, how did we miss that? But that's a huge piece of the Chernabog discussion, right?
Right.
It's not chess, it's checkers, it's a king. But when you throw in the sort of like Russian mystique, what's the first game you think of, right? And that's what those guys are. They're these like Russian, Slavic people. And, you know, the first kind of like strong person in that country was like Catherine the Great.
Sure.
And you think about Russians and board games, like chess comes to mind as well, yeah.
All right.
Power of the feminine. Yeah.
And with that, we're going to take a short break here. And when we return, we're going to talk some more spoilers as we look at what's different between the book and this week's episode. So take a listen to this and come on back. Let's take a look this week at the significant changes between the book and what we saw in this week's episode. I think in this case, it's pretty much, there's very little. We've veered significantly from the book at this point.
Yeah, and we've gotten where no man has gone before.
Yeah, yeah. You know, first of all, Easter takes out spring. First of all, in the book, now there was, in the book, when we meet Easter, it is in San Francisco, and the whole exchange where Wednesday is pointing out to Easter the obliviousness of her worshiping her as a specific person compared to the association of Easter with the resurrection of Jesus, that takes place on the street where Odin basically pulls regular people aside and asks them who they're worshiping when they're worshiping Easter. And like he basically takes a poll of people walking right down the street, and they basically say, you know, it's all about Jesus, or it's about, you know, the spring and renewal, but nobody ever remembers her specifically, and that sort of brings Easter down, brings Oster down, makes her realize that she does have something to fight for in this upcoming battle between the new gods and the old gods.
Right, Wednesday, ever the trickster, right? Ever yeah. trying to manipulate people to do his will. We've also got the difference that Tosin mentioned, like Jesus is all over this place.
Yeah.
Mary as well. Mary the virgin mother, or Mary the mother.
Yeah.
With baby Jesus, you know, so it's all sorts of Jesuses. That just doesn't happen in the book. And it's a weird omission from the book, honestly. When you read the 10th anniversary, he talks about it and he gives you a little scene about what he was trying to pull off and, you know, Jesus as a hippie kind of thing. But when you're reading the book about American gods and you realize that this country is like overwhelmingly Christian, it was hard to figure out where Jesus was, and this situation was really interesting. I would have liked to see a little bit more of the Jesus action. For instance, the kind of Jesus that Vulcan believes in, you know, perhaps a more conservative, righteous, Presbyterian style Jesus, Baptist style Jesus, that would have been cool, as opposed to sort of just these kind of like peace and love Jesuses. That would have been cool to see too. But Jesus was definitely not a thing in the books.
Yeah. Another thing is Bilquis. We see very little of Bilquis in the book, and as such, we don't really get any of her backstory. So it was nice to get her backstory in this episode, and definitely we did not see that Bilquis becomes an agent of Technical Boy or by proxy Mr. World. We don't see Bilquis joining the New Gods or siding with the New Gods as some sort of a deal in the book, because it just doesn't happen. We don't see, you know, her very much at all in the book.
No, we like see her die, and we see how she makes her life work, but we never see how she gets into this game, because she's not really a part of this game.
Yeah,
except for the fact that they want to take her out because she's old and they want as many followers as possible. And that kind of gives you some, that whole line about followers, just to go back to that,
yeah,
it gives you some perspective about what the New Gods want. They want everybody, which is why this war has to happen, right? Like, when you ask, why are they actually having, isn't everybody fine? Like, they seem to be fine. Why are they fighting one another? They want all the followers. And I thought that was pretty cool.
But we come to the end of this episode, and we see Bilquis, the very end, like the end tag in this episode is Bilquis on the bus driving to the House on the Rock. And I don't understand what part she's going to play, what sort of threat she is going to play to Wednesday and Shadow Moon, because
I think she's a mark, man. I think she's the honeypot. I think, you know, Wednesday, remember, so okay,
because this isn't in the book at all, like her role is in the book at all,
but I do think, like, now that I've thought about it a little bit, I feel as if, you know, in the, we know the story of Wednesday, he's talking about how he likes his like, you know, pale skinned women with the blue veins in their breasts and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that Bilquis will be able to seduce him, regardless of lacking those features, right? Because he likes to be with young guns. And she presents as one. Now, I mean, a god might be able to tell another god, and so that wouldn't work on him. But if it doesn't work on him, it can work on Shadow. And either way, if she can suck any one of those guys into her, like, vaginal universe, that's dealing a blow to the New Gods situation, especially because we know Wednesday has plans for Shadow. So
right.
I think she's on her way to pay whatever debt she has to Technical Boy and be rid of him. And she's going to do whatever she can to get to do that. So I think that's a clever way to bring her into the rising action of what's going to happen in the season two. But Tosin, take us out. What is the last big departure from the book?
The last big departure is that whole crazy scene with Wednesday where he somehow starts controlling lightning and shocks everyone, similar to how, you know, Thor would, but without a hammer, maybe a sword instead, tucked in his back pocket. I guess there can be only one. But yeah, no, that was a significant departure. You know, I think they were very coy with who Wednesday was for a while in the book, and we never really saw such dramatic control of power until, you know, potentially later in the book.
There's true.
Something that's talked about. So
right. But at this point in the book with Wednesday, he pretty much seems his power is very nominal, and in fact. Spoilers for the book, but he around this time he sacrifices himself, so we're not
right.
Like, I'm not sure, and again, this goes back to the way this season is played out as opposed to the way it is in the book. For all intents and purposes, it feels to me like we're leading up in this point in the story to go to the House on the Rock and have the final confrontation at the House of the Rock, on the Rock at the in sometime in the next season, which in the book that doesn't really occur until the very end of the story. And there's quite a bit of...
It's the climactic thing.
Yeah.
It's the whole thing that happens in the story, yeah.
There's quite a bit that goes on between now and then in the book, including what we didn't see was a previous visit to House on the Rock, where all the gods sort of met each other and decided that they were going to fight the new gods. And then, of course, there's a whole subplot in the book that takes place in this
the town of Lakeside
involving a serial killer, and we don't see any of that, not even a hint of that so far in this season, and it makes me wonder, you know, that they plan 5 seasons for the show, so is that stuff going to happen within the next 4 seasons, or are they going to ditch that whole subplot altogether and take this in a different direction entirely? I have no idea. I'm in completely blind territory.
Now that we're talking about the next season, and that's kind of the section we're in now, right? Next season, what we hope to see. I feel as if you're a reader of the book, if you know the book well, there's reason to believe that instead of having some sort of big battle at Lakeside, at the House on the Hill, rather, the House on the Rock, they effectively... They don't have that confrontation immediately, but perhaps Wednesday assembles his troops there, right? Perhaps Wednesday does that whole thing. And, you know, because of whatever's happening with Belkis or whatever, we might see Wednesday send Shadow away to hide, you know? This situation where he goes and he strikes these people down, it's not going to go unanswered. And when it goes answered, Wednesday has 2 choices. Mm. Fight in the open... Or basically regroup.
Right, right.
Like season 2 allows for that. And that's just me speaking as a person who is familiar with the way stories are written and how conflict emerges, right? So I think that I don't have like lost hope for season 2. But I do think that we're in a place where I felt at the end of, let's call it season 6 of our Game of Thrones, or the beginning of season 6, right? There are 5 books. And when season 6 began in Game of Thrones, I was like, I'm in the same place everybody else was. Oh, shit. You know what I mean? Whereas before, I had the kind of benefit and feeling that at least some framework of the book was gonna stay. Even though some people would die or some people would come back or whatever, I was going to have the framework of the book to stand on. So when I watched the show, I'd be fine. That took 6 seasons for me to get to kind of be like, okay, now I'm in the same place as everybody else. I'm just as, I guess, scared or whatever. With American Gods, I'm kind of happy that they're taking it into a place where I am now compelled to wonder what's going to happen. I've got to distract myself for a year until the season comes back, and I'm looking forward to it. Now, I do think it ended super strangely.
Yeah.
And I do hope that we get away from the, I am Odin, yada, yada, yada.
Right, right, stuff, right.
And more back to the sort of subtle stuff, because that's what the book was sort of good at, this subtle reimagining of gods in a modern time. As opposed to them standing resplendent in like the you know, the wilds of the world with lightning bolts at their beck and call. But, you know, I think there's a lot of good room for violence. It'd be cool to see Chernabog take people out. The big miss here, I think, is that there wasn't a way for them this season to introduce a few more bad guys so that when the lightning bolts hit, it wasn't just on blank faces.
Right, right.
Right. It would have been nice Minions. To see something that we really hated really get taken out.
Yeah.
Felt good about that. Meanwhile, as book readers, we're all wondering how Mad Sweeney's going to go. And we don't want him to go because he's such a wretched little piece of shit that we like so much.
Right. Well, chalk that up to Pablo for doing such a great job. But speaking of performances here, let's talk about our other performances. Notably, Kristen Chenoweth as Easter. I have to say that this
doesn't do anything wrong. She doesn't do anything badly.
And you know,
even her stops in that TV show she did, Nashville, even that is fantastic. And Nashville's awful.
I think this was perfect casting for her. Knowing everything that I know about Kristen Chenoweth's bubbly, bright, cheery personality, having her play Easter was just the spot on casting, and I can't imagine anybody else in this role.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that she has this ability to play smile on your face, scowl behind it.
Yeah.
Been doing since The West Wing, which she kind of did during Wicked, and she does in other places, even, you know, an aforementioned Nashville, you know, in front of the audience in the show, she's one way, and behind the scenes, she's another. She can both be smiley and saucy. And that kind of moxie is what makes this character work. Because she's like, you guys are telling me what to do. I don't really want to do what you're telling me what to do. But at the same time, I've got my own plans, and that's cool. I also like how she was kind of above it all. I'm not like you guys, right? I don't have this problem of people not liking me. And then when reality hit, she was quick to make her move. And that just shows you how virulent she is. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, Vulcan is a dude with all these guns and all this firepower, and he, like, is, you know, now that we know gods work in mysterious ways on the show, you know, that CEO that died of the Vulcan company that just fell in the vat of whatever.
Right.
The sacrifice, right. We know that was Vulcan. So he seemed really formidable.
We know he was responsible.
He was responsible. And he seemed really formidable, really unstoppable. And then Wednesday just chops off his head, you know? So it's really funny to see Easter, who's like, I'm not going to come across as super formidable, but I am. Or Wednesday, who's like, I'm an old man, but look how powerful I am.
Yeah, there's a lot of inconsistencies that I feel are...
I think that's kind of consistent. Like, what we're seeing is this idea that those people who show their power up front are not really powerful. But those people who keep their power hidden are more powerful. The trick is to be underestimated.
I don't know. I don't know if I buy that. I feel that there's a lot of inconsistency on the show that seems to be unjustified. So, but maybe I'm not reading enough into the subtext of what's going on. So, I mean, perhaps you're right. But it seems to me that there's more consistency in the book than the way the book has been translated on the show.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah. And as we, like, continue looking at what else we saw in this episode, I really like the lighting. You know, we talked about the lighting over the various Jesuses, but just the overall sort of colors that we had in the cinematography of this particular episode until we got to the very end with the whirling, swirling and whatnot.
Right.
But overall, even when, like, the clones appeared, it was just very well thought out and very well sort of... executed and oriented from sort of a positioning purpose. So that was I thought that was pretty good in this episode.
Yeah, I hope I see a bit more action next episode. This was a good lead up and build up and tension and suspense and stuff. But you know, when I see a whole bunch of clones cloning themselves and it's getting ready for a fight, it felt anticlimactic for them to kind of get like 7-1 blow knocked down. So I would like to see a bit more of the kind of thing where, you know, someone like Shadow, for instance, is in over his head in a physical situation and has to use his mind, like, you know, cleverness to get out of a situation. Or something where, you know, what we haven't seen and what I really miss from the book is this idea of backstage.
Right, 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 right. I would love to see that. Right, right. There's some great stuff in the book, and I really do hope they get into it. Maybe they're saving it for next season where... You know, Wednesday takes Shadow backstage to see the land of the gods behind the what humans see.
Right. When you see them in there, you see them in their sort of like imagined forms, like they're
right.
They're like the true forms. So that'd be cool. But in terms of overall performances this season, I got to give it to Browning and I think Ian McShane started off super strong.
Sure.
In his last couple episodes. I wasn't quite as impressed, but overall I think he's pretty much held the season together. I mean, I have to agree with you guys. I think Whittle, while talented, there needs to be some more development there, and I'm hoping that, like, you know, first season 8 episodes, you know, let's call it a warm-up. If it's going to be a 5-season thing, let's see season 2 show a stronger version of that. I'm still not certain that it's all apples to apples, because I feel like kind of what he's been given in terms of like script and everything, hey, act angry, not really working.
Hopefully, but sometime between now and next season, he'll get some acting lessons. I think that would be...
Oh, damn.
Really that's, helpful that's, for us as viewers.
That's dark. All right.
Wow. Talk about sucking the color out of the spring. Yeah.
I got it. Yeah, so I would say that I think Whittle definitely has to get to know the character a little bit better. I do think that a lot of the lines, like when I look at the actual words, because, you know, I'm writing down quotes as I check this stuff out. He's given a lot of the straight man boring stuff to say.
Right.
And that's
but
not.
But he doesn't have to deliver it in a boring
way. Being a straight man is a
way.
Real hard job.
Yeah.
But it's a real hard job that a lot of actors do. Right.
Yeah.
So Whittle does have to like step up and get that done. But I do think that that's. But I think that Browning has done a really good job. Pablo Schreiber, Browning, incredible breakout.
Pablo Schreiber, MVP of the season for me.
You think so? I think Browning did a really good job.
Her too, for sure.
Especially once we get to episode 4 and we see more Laura Moon than we thought we were going to see, and she holds it down incredibly well. Like I thought it was a very authentic layout. And then I expected McShane to do well, and I think he did very well. I thought Corbin Burnson was okay for his one episode.
Yeah.
And I think that same thing with Chenoweth and Easter. I think they're all doing what we expect of them, and I think that's kind of cool. So that was great.
All right. Let's talk about Ephemera. Some extra external links and stuff that will help you enjoy this show better. First of all, I want to link to the Wikipedia entry for Easter. Eostere, as Ian McShane pronounces it in the show, the legendary goddess of Easter. I was not aware of her until I read American Gods, and I'm sure a lot of people who are watching the show first was not aware that Easter had an origin beyond just the pagan season of renewal. So go to Wikipedia and bone up on her. And Dwayne, you have a link to share too, unfortunately.
Oh my God, you're leaving this one to me? Okay, well,
none of us would ever mention this one. So
I'm going to mention two things in the same franchise. One of them is completely awesome, and if you haven't seen it, get your geek on and get into it. And the second one is just so ridiculous, watch the first 15 minutes and get out. So the first one, Highlander, the film, right? Great film. It's from the early 80s. It kind of has Christopher Lambert randomly, a French man randomly playing a Scotsman, which historically isn't too bad because, you know, there's some stuff with Mary Queen of Scots. And
right,
French
but then you have a Scotsman playing an Egyptian who is a Spaniard.
Well, he's been living in Scotland for years, so there's that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The casting is definitely not perfect, but as movies in Hollywood and all that stuff goes, a lot of fun. But effectively, men with big swords managing the business of having to clash back and forth with them.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of fun. And then Highlander 2, which is a more modern layout of Highlander. But what's interesting, the reason why I actually bring it up is because when Wednesday pulls that sword out of his like random jacket,
right,
and it's a humongous sword, you know, this claymore effectively, that's the kind of thing that happens a lot in Highlander 2. They're walking around with normal clothes on, they pull these swords out, and it's kind of nuts. So I thought that was interesting, and it reminded me of that kind of like simple magic, simple camera tricks being done like that. So yeah, I thought that was cool. But yeah, we don't have a lot there because we're in such a new ground here that I feel like Ephemera matters less than just super paying attention to what's going on in the show. But as a first season for American Gods, overall, guys, on a score, one to five, you have to give it with one being the worst and five being the best. I find that I'm giving it a solid 4 in terms of being intrigued and entertained. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would also give it a 4, a solid 4. It's certainly, you know, in comparison, one of our other podcasts is Violent Delights, which covers HBO's Westworld, and I gave that one a 5. I would give that one a 5 in comparison, although we did not rate it at the time. But this series, so far, a 4.
Mm-hmm. Tosin, what about you?
Maybe a 3.42.
Okay, we're done with you.
And you know, I think that's kind of because it could be lower depending on how into the stylization you get. I do think like some of the earlier episodes were weaker. So the later ones have been much more stronger, and they've had several actors and actresses who've been here with major chops that have represented it well. There's mm-hmm. still some things in there that I don't completely appreciate, but mm-hmm. overall it's mm-hmm. pretty good. And you know, I think we'll see what happens next season. So,
yeah, for me, I definitely felt as if it was the stylistic choices and little things like the light that you like, the halos that were made this episode, things like that, the weird car driving on the mushroom. If I hadn't read the book, I would read this for the show. I'd look at the show, and I'd be just mystified. I'd be like, what am I watching? What's going to happen next? What is going on? And I'd be loving that. Except for like that last moment when Laura says, I need to talk to my husband.
Right. I'm not entirely sure what's going on there. There's so much at the end of this episode that I was not sure what's going on. I'm confused. I'm more confused than anything else. And it's not the type of confusion where I'm like, I'm super anxious to see how it all gets resolved. It's more like I'm just sort of left gobsmacked and confused.
There's a bit of like a what the fuck. Like, yeah. It would have been just as like useful if Laura had just like shot out a whole bunch of maggots and be like, oh, excuse me. And that was right. The end of that, right? It would have been the same thing. It was like, there's no value to that right now. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to see a great line from media closing it out.
And just the weird, like, face that Shadow had for her, even though she was clearly not looking that well. Like, just, it wasn't completely made sense. I actually thought, like, when she got
everything.
There, that I was like, oh, I thought she was, like, going to say, like, can I speak to Wednesday? Or, you know, like, get over here. like Mortal Kombat style.
She finds out Wednesday killed her, and she's like, I need to talk to my husband? I don't know. I also feel like, Gillian Anderson's performance was fantastic. She managed to morph into things. Her makeup team, brilliant. The question is, what was she made up as this last episode? I was hoping that she'd be someone really, again, another 20th century media icon would have been perfect. And she just kind of seemed to be, I guess this is what media looks like.
No, I don't think this is like her true form. I think she was just dressed up for Easter's party. You know.
Right. But it would have been nice if she were like, whether it was an anchor woman, like we see a little bit in the mm-hmm. the book, or you know, Scarlett O'Hara. She kind of felt like evocative of Scarlett O'Hara, but they didn't go full bore the way they did with Bowie and with Marilyn Monroe and Lucy. I feel like they could have done that, and it would have been. I mean, I guess she's not on screen for long enough to justify. I don't know, but it just felt like that was the kind of inconsistency that I could see bothering you a lot, Andy.
Yeah, I'm not too disturbed by this because it's not too much a... Again, I think it speaks to the inconsistency on the show. You know, if the show was being consistent, then every iteration that we see of media would have a direct reference to a specific literary person from literature. And this...
Or from TV, yeah. Or,
yeah. But media. This, not so much. So right. I'm okay with... I've accepted the inconsistency on this part, and there may be a bigger reason for this. There may be a bigger picture, but it does look like that we will be seeing more of media in season two, just because it seems to be consistent that they're using her a lot in this, which they don't. Again, she wasn't that big in the book. All right, so let's wrap this up. Let's start with you guys, and I'm going to ask you guys, where can we find you when you're not here on The Dominant Paradigm? Dwayne?
You can check me out on DwayneD.com, DwayneD. You can also check me out on Twitter, Twitter.com/DwayneD. I talk a lot about clean technology, green technology, the Internet of Things. That's kind of my MO. And then you can check me out when I hang out with these guys, but Andy will tell you more about that. Tosin, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, other stuff at toastr2d2.tumblr.com, and you can also find me at Geeks of Doom. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at mrbabyman.com, or just do a Google search for Andrew Cercini or Mr. Baby Man. That is my social media handle, and you'll find everything that I am liking and linking throughout the week there. You can also find me with these two fine gentlemen. We do two other podcasts. One is a weekly tech podcast called The Drill Down, and the other one is a podcast where we follow HBO's Westworld. And that podcast is called Violent Delights. You can find both of those on the Geeks of Doom podcast network or also on iTunes. And you can find all of us at Geeks of Doom, of course. That is going to do it for season one of Starz American Gods for us here on The Dominant Paradigm. We'll see you back here for season two. In the meantime, keep an ear out for us for season two of HBO's Westworld on our aforementioned podcast, Violent Delights. Also here on the Geeks of Doom podcast network and on iTunes. And until then, we'll see you next season on The Dominant Paradigm. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.